because some of the Egyptians are common. Now the Bible indicates that when that happens, there's going to be civil war in Egypt, because some of the Egyptians are communists and will be fighting on Russia's side, helping communism to take over, while some of the Egyptians are at least patriotic for their own country and will be fighting in its defense. Isaiah 19, verse 2, which he wrote in 714 B.C., says this, "And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight every one against his brother and every one against his neighbor, city against city and kingdom against kingdom." Now, all the civil wars in Egypt's ancient history were past when Isaiah wrote this. He wasn't prophesying something to happen in the next century or so. All that was past. And there has not been that kind of civil war that could answer to this since then. This is another of those prophecies aimed at our own day. So we can see how the picture begins to shape up. Definitely, though, Egypt will be overrun, conquered, and held and ruled for a while by these red invaders. Isaiah 19, verse 4 says, "And the Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them, saith the Lord of hosts." Now another interesting prophecy here. The prophet Zechariah, Zechariah 10, verse 11, prophesied this, "The scepter of Egypt shall depart away." The scepter, of course, that a king holds in his hand is the emblem of his right to rule, the governmental authority. Now, this was written in 487 B.C. At that time, Egypt was already a vassal of Persia. And thereafter, Egypt never became independent. All through Bible times, and in fact, down to our own time. This entire 10th chapter of Zechariah clearly refers to the time of the end. He wasn't prophesying about Egypt losing its independence in ancient times because it had already lost it long before he wrote this. This again is a prophecy directed to our own present time. So Egypt's treachery and hatred of the white world is going to receive its own proper reward. Now, we know, of course, that even if China and Russia do not cooperate on this last great attack, and the probability is they will cooperate, but even if they don't, if this attack is by Russia only, we know that she has military resources that outmatch all the free world. Thanks to Mr. McNamara, we have been disarmed to the point where we're not able to fight a very effective war against the Viet Cong. And fighting an effective war against an army of 15 million men that Russia could put in the field without any assistance from China is way beyond our capabilities. If all that were turned against us, if the only attack Russia made where she could concentrate all her forces were the one against Western Europe and the United States, we'd really be in for a rough time. We'd have no possibility, save by God's intervention, of surviving it. But Russia's desire to take this strategic place is going to draw off a large part of Russia's forces. Now, as an example of what I mean, the Japs knocked out our entire Pacific fleet at Pearl Harbor. If the Japs had had the brains and imagination to follow up their advantage, they would have come over here and taken our west coast, and they would have held everything west of the Rocky Mountains, and it would have been a very much different thing to try to get the Japs out. Instead of doing that, instead of throwing the knockout blow at us when we didn't have anything to interfere with their getting here, the Japs got greedy to see what they could seize in southern Asia and the islands of the Pacific. They threw all their army down there. They didn't have any troops to spare trying to land them on our coast, and they employed all their fleet not to make any attack here. They never even launched another attack against Hawaii after Pearl Harbor. They were trying to take a line from the southern tip of the Aleutian Islands down through Midway Island, down through the Philippines, and on down to New Guinea and possible Australia. They were just trying to occupy west of that. Now that is what gave us the time to get ourselves ready, to build a new navy, to make the Pacific coast the staging base for all of this, where we could accumulate supplies and troops and build our airplanes and so on, because it was our air arm that destroyed the Japanese Navy. So, the Japs diverting their energy in the wrong direction is what enabled us to win the war against Japan. Now the fact that so much of Russia's military power is diverted into the attack down there to get all the oil of the Near and Middle East, the Suez Canal, North Africa, sure, it's a tremendous prize, and they're greedy for it. And they pull so much of their forces down there that they don't have enough to throw at us. Well, we're going to have a rough time of it here. There will be Russian armies of great size landed here, and it's going to take the intervention of God to win the war for us, because traitors in Washington, D.C. have so effectively disarmed us. We don't have an airplane in production designed since World War II days except Mr. McNamara's Flying Edsel, which is the biggest failure since the days of the Wright brothers. We could have been building thousands of good airplanes, and he wouldn't allow it. We could have been building up a vast number of rockets to fire against Russia, and instead he has caused the destruction of far more than we built. Good, effective rockets. Oh, they were obsolete. In 10 or 15 years' time, we'd have better models. So he had them destroyed. He has not allowed us to create any anti-missile defense. So whatever rockets the Russians send over, all we can do is sit and wait for them to arrive. You remember, we have pulled out of all of our advanced rocket bases throughout the world. We had them in Europe, we had them in Turkey, we had them in Iran, where even the intermediate range missiles could reach all the vital parts of Russia. And thereby, we'd double or triple the number of rockets with which we could hit Russia. All those have been taken out. Our big overseas air bases from which we could have sent bombers over Russia to deliver atom bombs have been abandoned. Our capacity to hit Russia has been sabotaged knowingly and deliberately, and our means of defense against Russian attack has been sabotaged knowingly and deliberately. So with that, we face the oncoming war. Read this. Isaiah 43, verse 3. I am Yahweh, thy God, the Holy One of Israel, thy Savior. I gave Egypt for thy ransom, Cush and Sheba for thee. Well, Sheba is Western Arabia, especially Saudi Arabia, which, as you know, is one of the tremendous oil centers there. Now, Cush, your King James Version, in some of the, this is one of the 27,000 odd places where it's wrong, mistranslated. They have translated the Hebrew Cush as Ethiopia. In ancient times, there were two kingdoms known as Cush. Now, wherever you see Ethiopia, that, of course, is the deliberate forgery by the translator. No Bible writer ever wrote the name Ethiopia. It is a Greek name, and nobody who wrote any of the books of the Old Testament ever heard the Greek language. It was one of two kingdoms that were called Cush. Now, in Babylonia, in the Euphrates Valley, there was quite a kingdom there. You see, Babylonia, like Assyria, went through its periodic ups and downs. There'd be a century or two when it was a great empire, and then it would fall into hard times, so to speak, and become of no consequence, and some other kingdom would be the important one. For a period of about 300 years, about 150 years before the Exodus from Egypt and about 150 years after it, there was this kingdom of Cush in Babylonia. Today we would call that Iraq, which you remember is one of the great oil-producing Arab states of the Middle East. Now, the prophet Isaiah did not write Ethiopia. He wrote Cush. Now, if you want to translate that as Ethiopia in Africa, there is some possible justification for it. Today, Ethiopia is the biggest center of Russian subversive activity in Egypt. From Ethiopia, the distribution of Russian arms to the nations that their nations, so-called, these nigger tribes, that they're trying to get to revolt against white civilization. All this stuff fans out from Ethiopia. Now, if you translate this as the other Cush, today Iraq, a great oil center, obviously that is one of the things that Russia is most eager to seize, not only to get its oil resources for herself, but to make sure that the free world gets no chance at that oil. For defense. So, as he says, I gave Egypt for thy ransom, Cush and Sheba for thee. God had a hand in this, in persuading the Russians to make a big attack down there, probably the biggest military attack of the two, that is, in the sense of armies, which pulled that much of their force away from us. Now, there's no event in ancient history that can correspond to this prophecy. So this, again, is a case where Isaiah was looking far into the future, to our own time. Well, you note how all these things fit together. Now, there's another interesting prophecy in Isaiah. Well, several others concerning Egypt. An intervention is going to come in there to defeat the Russian attack through Egypt. Not that it stops them from getting it, but it's going to check the utility of it. Isaiah 19, verses 5 to 7. And the river, it's speaking of the river Nile, the river shall be wasted and dried up, and they shall turn the river far away, and the Nile channels shall be emptied and dried up. The reeds and flags shall wither, the paper reeds by the brooks, by the mouth of the brooks, and everything sown by the brooks shall wither, be driven away, and be no more. The sources of the Nile are in the high mountainous country of Africa, way back in Ethiopia. As several minor rivers there which empty into the White Nile and the Blue Nile, and these come together to form the Nile River flowing northward through the Sudan, or Nubia as they called it in ancient times, on down into Egypt. Now, Egypt is a relatively low country. Way back at the southerly part, you don't have any great elevation. But as you get on up onto the high plateau back of that, the Nile flows through a relatively shallow valley in one place. The hills enclosing it on the east and on the west are not much above the level of the valley floor. And if the river ever broke through those hills on the east, it would go on down the slope into the Red Sea. And if it broke through on the west, it would empty out into the Sahara Desert. Now, probably some of you remember that during World War II, when there was a great deal of wonder whether the Germans were going to capture Egypt and the Suez Canal and so on, there was a good deal of discussion whether, as a matter of desperate military necessity, the Nile was going to be turned. Because to the north of this valley, the river cuts through a deep, narrow gorge. And if you put a couple of carloads of good modern explosives properly planted in the cliffs lining that gorge and blew these great masses of rock down there, you'd block that gorge with a dam. You'd hold the Nile River back of that, and it wouldn't have to rise very much in that lake until it would overflow these low hills and start cutting itself a new channel. And there was considerable discussion whether that was going to be done. It wasn't done then, but the fact that military engineers were considering it shows that it was a practical thing. Now, it could be done, of course, by earthquake. Earthquake shaking down these cliffs to form the dam, or earthquake breaking a fault line rift through these low hills, either one. The way this prophecy is phrased, "and they shall turn the river far away," seems to indicate it probably is done not by natural forces, but by military action. But you can see here exactly what might happen. If that were done, Egypt would become uninhabitable. Their water supply gone. You not only couldn't raise any food, you couldn't take a bath, which wouldn't greatly disturb the people of Egypt, and you couldn't even take a drink, which would be a different thing. Now there's a prophecy also about the closing of the Suez Canal. If you remember your geography, on the east coast of Africa, the Red Sea comes up, separating the east coast of Africa from the Arabian Peninsula. And when you get pretty well up the Red Sea, it forks. You have one branch, the Gulf of Suez, that goes to the left or west along the coast of Egypt. And the Suez Canal comes in to the head of that Gulf of Suez. The other branch goes to the right around the Sinai Peninsula and comes on up, that's the Gulf of Aqaba, to the port there of Eilat, where you remember the Egyptians and the Jews were fighting over whether Egypt was going to close that to Jewish traffic to this port of Eilat. Well, now, the Gulf of Suez is what is known here as the tongue of the Egyptian Sea. Isaiah 11, verse 15. I'm reading it from Smith and Goodspeed's Modern English Translation because it's much clearer in that. "Then Yahweh will dry up the tongue of the Sea of Egypt with the glowing heat of his breath, and he will shake his hand over the river and will smite it in the seven brooks and will enable men to cross it with sandals." Your King James Version says, cross it dry shod, which is about as good an expression for it, too. Now, the Nile River, at its northerly end in the delta, branches into seven channels. And in ancient days, all seven of those channels had enough water in them to be navigable. But today, five of those channels have filled up with silt and mud to the point where there isn't much water in them. Only two of them carry enough water to be navigable today. And certainly, if anything happened to check the flow of the Nile from above, well, you could walk across those seven streams dry shod, no question of it. Now, we might be seeing the first stage of this. The fact that it says he'll dry up the tongue of the Sea of Egypt with the glowing heat of his breath indicates, of course, God's intervention there with the terrific forces of nature, quite possibly earthquake and volcanic action in there. But now the tongue of the Egyptian Sea goes on up into this Suez Canal, which runs about 100 miles from the Mediterranean at the port of Alexandria at the north end down to the port of Suez at the south end. And that is not like some of the other canals. Remember, this is desert sand that is dredged through. It is not good solid soil. It's loose sand. And only by constant dredging are they able to keep the Suez Canal navigable. Now, any ship has to be kept moving at a reasonable rate of speed or you lose all control of it. And therefore, ships have to steam through this Suez Canal at a fair rate of speed. It's only about 275 feet wide, and they have to keep such control that they're not going to veer a little bit off to one side and run aground. So they have to move fast enough to keep good steerage way. And that means likewise that the bow waves these ships raise wash with considerable force against these sand banks of the canal. And they're constantly washing loose sand down into the bottom of the channel. And only constant dredging keeps it open. Now, even without the ships passing through, this loose sand keeps tending to sift down into the bottom of it. Since last June, no dredging activity has been permitted. There are a number of ships in the Suez Canal now, which were caught there at the time of the war last June, have not been able to get out. The canal is blocked at both ends by ships that were sunk there during the fighting. And besides that, the Jews would open fire on anything that tried to move, so these ships are in there. It's very doubtful if any of these ships, unless very small ones, could be gotten out of the Suez Canal now, even if the Jews stopped interfering, because they would first have to redredge that canal considerably. Now, are the Jews going to stop this blockade of the canal? Certainly not. They've got a terrific leverage over Egypt. Remember that Egypt has to have money to buy from abroad and import the things she needs to live. Manufactured goods of all kinds and food. Her one source of cash, the cotton crop, is gone for years to come because the Russians get it in its entirety. The only way Egyptian cotton reaches the world markets today is when Russia resells it. The only other source of cash income to Egypt is the tolls from the operation of the Suez Canal, what they charge ships to pass through. Now, the Jews are able to shut off that source of income from Egypt, and Egypt is hurting pretty badly from lack of that cash. So the Jews are not about to give up that advantage. And there is not in the government of the rest of the world a man honest enough to block the Jews from doing this. Remember, the Jews own your politicians as they do those of the other nations of the world, own them like you own your dog. and they make him come to heal just as obediently. So that's the way the matter stands. The probability is that it's going to be a long time to come before dredging is going to be permitted. I doubt if the Russians care to have it opened up until they themselves take it over. So we may have seen right now the first step of this drying up of the tongue of the Egyptian sea. Now there's one more tremendous prophecy about Egypt. This was written by the prophet Ezekiel in 588 B.C. It's Ezekiel 29, verses 10 to 12. Nothing corresponding to this has ever happened in ancient times. So he wasn't writing about old Bible times. He was writing about the things that are going to happen in the near future now. Speaking of Egypt, behold, therefore, I am against thee and against thy river, and I will make the land of Egypt utterly waste and desolate, from the Tower of Syene even unto the border of Ethiopia. Now, Syene is what today we call Aswan. You remember that there is already a big dam on the Nile River at Aswan to hold back the annual floodwaters of the Nile and impound them there so they can be released gradually throughout the year. And the Russians are in the process of building, they haven't quite completed yet, a much higher dam at Aswan. Not only is northerly Egypt, lower Egypt, going to be obviously rendered desolate when the flow of the Nile is shut off, but we're talking now about upper Egypt, southern Egypt, from the Tower of Syene, or Aswan, to the border of Ethiopia. No foot of man shall pass through it, nor foot of beast shall pass through it, neither shall it be inhabited 40 years. And I will make the land of Egypt desolate in the midst of the countries that are desolate, and her cities among the cities that are laid waste shall be desolate 40 years. And I will scatter the Egyptians among the nations and will disperse them among the countries. Yes, you shut off their water supply, and the only way they can hope to stay alive is to move on out into any other country that will accept them as refugees. As I say, these things have not yet come to pass, because these tremendous prophecies of this last great war with which the age comes to an end haven't quite gone into effect yet. We see all the maneuvering, the nations getting into position for this battle. We see everything pointing up to it. We see the traitorous intrigues of our own politicians helping to bring about this war against us and destroying our own ability to resist it. And that is why the Bible shows we're going to be rescued from it by the direct intervention of God Himself. Because we have reached the point where human efforts would not be sufficient. Now, in all these tremendous things that are going to happen, where all the history of the world comes to this great turning point, this little and obnoxious nation of Egypt is going to play a surprisingly big part, not in what it does, merely in being the scene of some of these battles. It's not important for what it is, it's important for where it is. So when I sometimes spend some time talking about these countries that were important in ancient times, I'm not just giving you a lesson in ancient history. The Bible doesn't bother making prophecies about any of the nations that perished in the ancient times. The Bible never even speaks of any nation except as it came in contact with God's people Israel. The enormous empire of China, a great flourishing civilized nation thousands of years before the first book of the Bible was written, never is mentioned. The many kingdoms in India get no mention. the great Aztec, Toltec, and Inca empires on this continent never are mentioned. None of those came in contact with God's people Israel. Now, some of the nations that did come in contact with them for purposes of trouble always and perished in ancient times are mentioned briefly, historically, as just a record of what happened. But the Bible never bothered making these great prophecies about any nation or any people except those who would still be important in these last days. You remember that in your New Testament, I forget which book, it's one of Paul's as I remember it, where he says that these prophets wrote their books for us upon whom the end of the age has come. And he was right. The things that exist today have their roots in the ancient past. You wouldn't be here today if you didn't have ancestors who lived thousands of years ago. And you wouldn't have the institutions that you have today if they also didn't have their roots in the ancient past. So never be impatient with parts of the Bible that deal with some of these old nations. They, either in the institutions they created, like the Babylonian economic system that is destroying us today, the Babylonian religious system that has corrupted our churches today, the Assyrian, who were hook-nosed Jews, and whose descendants are in charge of communism in Russia today. All these people the Bible prophesied about after their ancient kingdoms had been destroyed. Because these things still are in effect today, and you'd better pay attention because your own personal destiny is being considerably changed by them. As refugees. As I say, these things have not yet come to pass because these tremendous prophecies of this last great war with which the age comes to an end haven't quite gone into effect yet. We see all the maneuvering, the nations getting into position for this battle. We see everything pointing up to it. We see the traitorous intrigues of our own politicians helping to bring about this war against us and destroying our own ability to resist it. And that is why the Bible shows we're going to be rescued from it by the direct intervention of God Himself. Because we have reached the point where human efforts would not be sufficient. Now, in all these tremendous things that are going to happen, where all the history of the world comes to this great turning point, this little and obnoxious nation of Egypt is going to play a surprisingly big part, not in what it does, merely in being the scene of some of these battles. It's not important for what it is, it's important for where it is. So when I sometimes spend some time talking about these countries that were important in ancient times, I'm not just giving you a lesson in ancient history. The Bible doesn't bother making prophecies about any of the nations that perished in the ancient times. The Bible never even speaks of any nation except as it came in contact with God's people Israel. The enormous empire of China, a great flourishing civilized nation thousands of years before the first book of the Bible was written, never is mentioned. The many kingdoms in India get no mention. The great Aztec, Toltec, and Inca empires on this continent never are mentioned. None of those came in contact with God's people Israel. Now, some of the nations that did come in contact with them for purposes of trouble always and perished in ancient times are mentioned briefly, historically, as just a record of what happened. But the Bible never bothered making these great prophecies about any nation or any people except those who would still be important in these last days. You remember that in your New Testament, I forget which book, it's one of Paul's as I remember it, where he says that these prophets wrote their books for us upon whom the end of the age has come. And he was right. The things that exist today have their roots in the ancient past. You wouldn't be here today if you didn't have ancestors who lived thousands of years ago. And you wouldn't have the institutions that you have today if they also didn't have their roots in the ancient past. So never be impatient with parts of the Bible that deal with some of these old nations. They, either in the institutions they created, like the Babylonian economic system that is destroying us today, the Babylonian religious system that has corrupted our churches today, the Assyrian, whose descendants are in charge of communism in Russia today, all these people the Bible prophesied about after their ancient kingdoms had been destroyed. Because these things still are in effect today, and you'd better pay attention because your own personal destiny is being considerably changed by them.
This tape was produced by Your Heritage of San Diego, California. We have much more information in written form and in tape recordings, both reel and cassette. This material is offered to the personal ministries of those who are called to awaken God's Israel sheep to the truth of His Word and the necessity for national repentance. We welcome your suggestions as to how Your Heritage can more effectively spread the gospel of Christ's earthly kingdom. Many people meeting in their homes are using our material to help in their studies. Such groups represent a healthy return to the form of assembly as practiced by the apostles, and offers those who finally see the light and come out of the Babylonian denominational system a place to worship with other believers. As you know, Your Heritage is not associated with any organization. As our congregation, we depend upon your tithes and offerings to pay our expenses in spreading the gospel of the kingdom.
Please send all correspondence to our new private zip code, Your Heritage, San Diego, California, 92116-0100. And now goodbye, and may God richly bless you.